702.
Weekend Breakfast with Rifilwe Mbakanyane.
Let's walk the talk.
Going on 6:38 on the Sunday edition of Weekend Breakfast. We're going to be talking conservation, taking a peek into Tim Neary's Nature Diary. And what we're focusing on today is a book which is called The Shaping of Shaping Ador, the story of a South African national park. The book is written by Mitch Reardon and printed by Penguin Random House. Really, really interesting story that Mitch brings us, which focuses on, you know, South Africa's that famed, acclaimed Eastern Cape Ado Elephant National Park, which is home to a unique population of elephants. A sad past, and you know, the sad reality is that they were almost a century ago, those elephants in the Eastern Cape were systematically hunted until there were only 16 left. So really interesting story that Mitch Reardon tells in his book. And of course, the success story is what inspires us mostly about the fact that, you know, today there are about 650 elephants in the Ado Elephant National Park, which is the densest concentration of wild elephants anywhere on the planet. We'll go on to talk with Tim Neary about various issues, including alien invader plants in Johannesburg. But with that, it's good morning, Tim. Always interesting conversations that you're bringing us in our conversation, conservation conversations.
Yeah, that katana gets the lips of you. Sort of almost feel you're running in the lips for a camel. You get one runs one's mouth over them quite often. But yeah, it's a beautiful morning this morning. As what I'm enjoying at this time of year is as we come on air, then the light changes and we go from that darkness to suddenly where I can read what's in front of me.
Yeah.
And of course the garden gets that beautiful light onto the trees. So it's all looking very nice this morning.
And before that, just that crisp morning air is really invigorating. Absolutely. Love it this time of year.
I don't know about invigorating, but I find when I'm sitting waiting, I'm now looking for a blanket.
Well, it certainly does wake you up, right? And get you ready to start the day. Well, Tim, you have brought us some really interesting, a really interesting book and title and a story that is one that we should all, you know, be aware of as South Africans. But really quickly, your own relationship, your own personal relationship with the Ado Elephant National Park. Tell us about it. I'm sure there's one.
Yeah, there kind of is, because obviously I come from Port Elizabeth, so Ado was our closest park that we could go to. And, you know, you were always told about these elephants, but I think because they had mostly been under so much pressure in the early years, they were very shy.
Yeah.
And you would go to the park and you knew there were elephants there, but you just never saw them. And, you know, the bushes were rustle and what have you, and you would drive around looking for them. And at that stage, the park was a lot smaller as well.
Yeah.
It didn't extend to all the new lands that they brought in. It wasn't effectively a park with a marine frontage either at that point in time. But it was a lovely area just to go to. And it was, and the thickets, the bush thickets in that part of the world are so interesting. And one always, as a little person, you always dreamt that the elephants were busy walking between Knysna and Ado. And, you know, you would go to the Karoo because there were elephant bones that were in the Karoo and the odd tusk or two that would be found in the bush. And you'd go off to the places like the Kom de Boer and go and look and see, oh, wow, you know, are these elephants, are they all interrelated? So, yeah, it just always brought out some little mysteries to one's brain.
Well, thanks for bringing us this conversation and joining us to explore more and talk more about Ado is Mitch Reardon, who's a wildlife photographer and, of course, author of this book we'll be discussing today, Shaping Ado, the story of a South African national park. Mitch Reardon, welcome to Weekend Breakfast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you.
An absolute pleasure. Mitch, I'm going to start off by, you know, asking you to just tell us, run us through the process of, you know, lining up the story of this really important national park and, the decades worth of material and work. What does it even begin to look like? Obviously, you've had tons of practice with your other titles like Shaping Kruger as well as Wild Karoo. But what was the process of, you know, writing this book?
I follow the same process as I usually do. I look at the history of the place And I'm particularly interested in natural ecology, animal behavior, mm-hmm. but also management. And that's the part where people come into the picture.
Yeah, yeah. Tim, go ahead.
Mitch, morning. The shaping Addo itself, Addo has mostly got one of the most checkered histories of any of our parks in South Africa.
Yeah, very much so. It almost wasn't. The going back to about around 1919, the idea was, in fact, to exterminate the elephants because they were interfering with farming. The area was being cleared of its traditional, what is called spekboom, and, of course, these famous orchards were going in, and that area is today still famous for its oranges and grapefruits. The elephants were interfering with that, and it was decided to get rid of them. And that almost succeeded. A fellow called Jan Pretorius came in, hunting under really difficult circumstances, managed to reduce the herd, which they guessed was around 120, to just 16 survivors. And at that point, people stepped in and said, we shouldn't kill them all, we should save a few. And that was the beginning of the Addo Elephant National Park story.
And tell us, you know, the various stakeholders that came to the fore to establish the national park. What did it look like in those early days? And, you know, what resources were available to begin it?
Interestingly, there weren't that many people who sort of championed the elephant's cause, unlike today. I mean, today people are really concerned, for instance, about rhinos being killed for their horns. In those days, most people were on the sides of the hunter. That was just the mentality of the time. Mm-hmm. But there were people that really did care. And eventually, and including Pretorius, he also said we shouldn't get rid of them all. We should save a few. And the problems continued because the park wasn't fenced and the elephants continued going off the area that had been designated as a park and interfering with the farmers. And eventually they did manage to get all the elephants back into this particular small area that had been set aside, and they did manage to put up a fence that could resist the best efforts of the elephants to escape. Mm-hmm. And then in the 1930s, it was declared a national park.
Okay.
Mitch, you mentioned that fence as well, but even that fence has got a huge strangement to it. I don't think one's ever seen a fence anywhere else of its magnitude.
Yeah, that's right. So only a section of Addo, interestingly enough. Addo is now the third largest national park in South Africa, but only a section of it is elephant-proof fenced. And there are other large areas that haven't been fenced, and as a result, there are no elephants in them. And that's one of the projects for the future, because there are now over 650 elephants in the sort of main camp area, as it's called, and they want to come up with situations where these elephants can disperse. But the first thing they need to do is to make sure that they don't wander off reserve, as they say. So they've got to put in a fence at some point.
Mm-hmm. The Elies as well have got estrangement, though, because you always hear people talking about the Addo elephants, the tuskless elephants. I've seen a couple of tuskless elephants also up in the Mpopo area, but that became almost their signature, didn't it?
Absolutely, and that was a result of basically ivory hunting. So in those days, people would go out and they would go after the elephants with the biggest tusks. Once they'd been shot out, they went after elephants that had medium-sized tusks. So it was a kind of selection process. And at the end, most of the cows didn't have tusks. And that continued until quite recently when it was decided by SANParks to change that as much as possible, and they started introducing bulls from the Kruger National Park, and we're now seeing a lot more calves born and go on to produce tusks. So it was only the cows that were tuskless. The bulls always had tusks.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch, the size of the park, you mentioned that it's the third largest park. And I mean, good heavens, Addo, the early Addo was sort of like a postage stamp. What has created the greater side of this park, though, the larger, the new landscape?
It's a really tough piece of country. It's semi-desert, a lot of it. And over the Zeerbach, which was the sort of northern perimeter, is the Nama Karoo, which is kind of true desert. Well, it's semi-desert. And it's very, very tough farming. Basically, people were struggling to make a living. And as their land came up for sale, basically, as they abandoned farming and just got out altogether, Sandparks was buying up the farms and including them into Addo with the idea of having this enormous space where Addo could establish its own ecology instead of being intensely managed, as was the case prior.
And expand on that, Mitch, for us in terms of establishing its own ecology and growing that. What were the happy but unintended consequences of that? What else is to be found and seen at Addo now?
Well, lions were brought back, spotted hyenas were brought back, black rhinos, which had been hunted out altogether, came back. What they thought of as the sort of Cape rhino didn't survive. So they brought in rhinos which they thought were very close relatives from Namibia, and they've done particularly well in the park. And I should at this point say, just on that subject, that because of good management, not a single rhino has ever been poached in Addo. So that's really something that Addo can be proud of.
Sure.
And there were some interesting developments once the lions came in. These lions came from the Kalahari, and they hadn't seen a lot of the animals that are found in the Addo section, particularly buffaloes. And at first, and the buffaloes had never seen lions. So at first, these two important species sort of eyed each other warily but did nothing about it. And then the lions started hunting the buffaloes, and they found them fairly easy to hunt because the buffaloes just didn't know how to react. In other parts of Africa, buffalo herds actually gather around and they'll rush in and rescue one of their friends who's been captured by lions. But in Addo, they didn't originally. They just stampeded. And the calves got left behind and they got picked off. Eventually, interestingly enough, the buffaloes learned to do exactly what buffaloes do elsewhere, and they started protecting themselves.
Sure.
But as the lion population increased, they were taking a heavy toll of the buffaloes, which for the buffalo herd in Addo is a very important herd. It's totally disease-free, and if you want to restock, say, a private game farm or anywhere, really, with buffaloes, they have to be disease-free. So they were all coming from Addo, and they didn't want to lose too many buffaloes to lions, understandably. So about 2 or 3 years ago, the lion population was reduced. They were captured, half of them were captured and sent off to other places.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of the lionesses are actually on pregnancy pills.
So, Mitch, I want to go back, just circle back to the point that you made about rhinos and the fact that there's been no poaching of rhinos at Addo. What have they gotten right? Is it from a management perspective? And does it in any way also just point to the specific sort of, I guess, value chain or how poachers operate in other parks?
Yeah, it's really not a question of good luck. It's definitely good management. And they've got a very successful anti-poaching system in place. If suspicious characters come in through the gate, in other words, the people at the gate radio ahead to the camp, and the rangers keep an eye on them just to make sure they're not up to some criminal activity. And it's worked. It's just become too difficult to poach in Addo, so they go elsewhere.
So heavy surveillance has been at the root of it.
Absolutely. And they've got all kinds of systems set up, like I'm not quite sure how they do it technically, but they have things where if you walk through and it breaks the connection, just like an alarm in a house.
Sure.
A warning goes off on a ranger's smartphone to say, something's going on here, something has broken the beam, and it looks like it's human.
Interesting.
And then they're going to investigate.
Very interesting. Tim, I'm going to give you the final word.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting facts is that Mitch mentioned the black rhino there, which is the desert black rhino, and the Fish River is thought to be the barrier between where the desert black rhino changes to the eastern black rhino. So it's kind of an interesting, and there's a slight difference in the animals. But yeah, I think it's awesome as well. And Mitch, of course, it's our only real national park that has both land and sea as part of the park. And I think that also extends it greatly into some extremely interesting areas all the way down to Bird Island.
And that's a really important thing. So one of the most important conservation developments is that large sections of Algoa Bay where Bird Island and the other islands are, and these are very, very important seabird, marine bird breeding habitats. And today we think of elephants and rhinos as possibly being endangered species, and they are to a degree. The most endangered species in Addo is the African penguin, and hardly anybody knows anything about it, about, you know, its conservation status. And it's basically because of overfishing.
Mm.
And that is now being controlled. It's being far more carefully policed. And hopefully the penguins, whose numbers have just been declining really steadily, will turn around and start increasing again.
Mitch, I lied. I do have one final question, which is, in all the research and the writing, what was that fundamental takeaway that you gleaned from your time spent putting together this book? What makes, you know, obviously the numbers a success, the concentration of elephants, but what makes Addo particularly unique, if one could say that?
I think it comes back to the elephant. I heard you saying in the introduction just how shy the elephants were.
Mm-hmm.
Elephants are very intelligent animals, and they've learned that they're safe in Addo. And they have to be the most chilled elephants in Africa. They come right up next to the vehicles without any alarm. They bring their calves up to have a look at you. It's a wonderful experience. Some people say, oh, well, you know, elephants are supposed to be wild. No, not necessarily. Why? The only time they're wild is when they're afraid of you. Now you can actually sit in a herd of elephants quietly and watch them go about their business and see for yourself just how fascinating elephant society is.
Mm. Interesting stuff. Fascinating. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really enjoyed speaking to you, Mitch.
Right. It was lovely to be on the program. Thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure. That's Mitch Reardon, wildlife photographer and author of Shaping Addo, the story of a South African national park. Tim, you always just find us such gems and such interesting conversations to have. Really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. And of course, yeah, Mitch did say that the elephants are chilled. The Eastern Cape has some of the best dacha in the country. Now you know why the elephants are chilled.
I've certainly not heard elephants being described as chilled. So yeah, I enjoyed that anecdote. Absolutely. But Tim, you know, carrying on our conversation into other matters, nature related, you wanted to point out and just unpack for us alien invader plants in Johannesburg that we need to be aware of and cognizant of. What's on that list?
Yeah, you know, I've been going around and looking at the lantana, et cetera, that lurks around Johannesburg. And we've got all our laws and everybody gets all excited. And the municipality jump up and down. And I do think it's time that the municipality looked at their own landscape. And, you know, when I look at the amount of lantana that is just on my way to gym in the morning, it's incredible. And I drive past a municipal library, and it's got a far better selection of alien invader plants surrounding it than anywhere else.
Oy.
And I do think that it's time that if we are going to look at this battle, let's just stop talking about the fact that it's the responsibility of the residents of Johannesburg. And come on, council, let's clean up your own areas first.
And of course, lantana is known as one of the worst weeds in the world, right?
Oh, we've got lantana, we've got bugweed. I mean, I found bugweed the other day where the trunks of the bugweed are the size of my upper arm. And, you know, the bugweed is one of the best plants that one could have for paper production or pulping, I should say. Sure. It's one of the really best ones. Only problem is it only grows in degraded landscapes, so you can't plant forests of it. Mm. So, you know, here we go with a bit of a problem. But, yeah, it is an issue. And if we are going to attend to it, we need to attend to it properly.
And, of course, not attending to it means what? What's at risk over here?
Well, it just means that it's going to continue going into different people's gardens, and it's going to be seeded by birds. Birds are our best seeders of our alien invader plants like that. And, of course, they grow in degraded landscapes, as we say, mm-hmm. and therefore that means that soil or that area needs to be remanaged. And it's quite easy for them to bring back the local grasses because that, of course, will also start to throttle off your local grasses. Mm. Very little grows under those plants, and I think that's one of our bigger issues as well. Not the water they take up, but it's the fact of they are slowly but surely eradicating our indigenous grasses and our indigenous plants.
Sure. Another development with the city proposing a formal introduction of a recycling levy. I think Joburg residents have definitely seen those new clear recycling plastic bags being dropped off in their driveways or their gates. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, we're going to hopefully get the council on to come and try and explain themselves as to where they came up with this punitive. It's a punitive tax. That's all it is. You know, I'm fascinated, and we'll discuss it with them. What happens to the plastic collectors? Or do they just get sidelined? It's a whole business. And we had this whole test run a couple of years ago where they brought us the bags, and then they threw them both into the same compacting truck. Their compacting trucks are designed for the wheelie bins, and many other countries utilize two wheelie bins, mm. and they collect on 1 week, they collect the wheelie bin that has got your normal waste in it, and on the second week, they collect the next wheelie bin, which has got your recyclables in. So why are we taking out plastic bags? And I see the law changes on Wednesday next week, just before Earth Day, the law changes. Sure. Where we're going to now have to have X amount of recycled plastic in the plastic bags, in the poor quality bags that we get at most of our shopping centres. And what does fascinate me is that the higher the concentration of that recycled plastic, the weaker the bags are going to become.
I'll certainly keep an eye on that. Thanks so much, Tim Neary. We'll chat to Tim next Sunday.